From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been 6 years since President Clinton stood at the helm of a complete overhaul of America's welfare system. Under the new system, welfare became a temporary aid program, which demanded that the poor get to work and get off the public dole. Today, President Bush stood in a Little Rock church and extolled the new era of welfare.
It's been a huge success in America. It's important for Americans to understand when they hear the talk about welfare reform that the 96th law has made a significant difference in millions of people's lives.
Now, President Bush is pushing Congress to adopt even tougher work requirements for welfare recipients. With the 1996 bill due to expire this fall, Congress is debating the future of the country's welfare policy. The House has already passed a new, more stringent program, and the Senate is now preparing to take up the debate. Dr. June O'Neill is former director of the Congressional Budget Office and has been studying the impact of the 1996 welfare reform. I spoke with her earlier and asked her to give us the big numbers that describe the results of welfare reform since 96.
There are two really big and startling numbers. One is the dramatic decline in the welfare caseload. The welfare caseload's declined by more than half since the beginning of welfare reform. They had already begun to decline during the mid-90s, but between August of 1996 and last fall, the decline was from 4.4 million families on welfare to about 2 million families on welfare. Really dramatic
change. So it's an enormous decline in the overall absolute number of families participating in welfare.
Yes, and that can actually, you know, one would want to look at it the way we've looked at it in terms of the percentage of single mothers, the major group that, you know, that is on welfare and that was on welfare. And that decline was similarly dramatic.
Of the 2 million families on welfare now, June O'Neill, what percentage are single mothers?
Oh, most of them. The major program, TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, is essentially families headed by a single mother.
So the welfare rolls were cut about in half. Was there an impact on poverty in the United States?
Okay, well, I believe that there was. But the other statistic that would indicate why that would be the case is that the work participation of single mothers really has increased to an extent that, you know, looking at the numbers, I know when I first became aware of it, I thought, oh, this must be a typo. It couldn't possibly be true. If you go back to 1989, which was the peak year in terms of the economy during the 1980s, 71% of single mothers worked.
This is of single mothers
of single
in poverty
mothers.
Or of
no,
all single mothers in the country?
No, just single mothers. And the percentage poor among single mothers has always been very high. Single mothers have always been a major contributor to high poverty in the country. Mm-hmm. It was 71%. And in 2000, that had increased to 84%. However, if you also look in terms of the amount of time during the year that single mothers work, that's increased also amazingly. 54% of single mothers worked for a full-time year-round. That means at least 35 hours a week and 52 weeks during the year. That's extraordinary.
Of the number of families or people who moved off welfare, how many moved into jobs and how many just dropped out of the program because it became more difficult to meet its requirements?
Well, the statistics that I gave you suggest that the overwhelming majority must be working because the percent working is so huge. But among all single mothers who are not on welfare, 88% were working in the year 2000. So that means that most have, in fact, found employment.
So work has become much more the norm. What about poverty? Has the percentage or number of Americans, single mothers, I guess, in poverty changed?
Yes, no, that has declined really sharply as well. Just the basic statistics of the decline in poverty show a very large decline in poverty.
So the big numbers must look gratifying for people who push through this welfare reform. Are there numbers that give you pause or concern in your research, June?
I haven't seen anything that would give me concern about welfare reform. We've had many welfare reforms, but this is the only one that I think was truly ever a reform, that it did change the philosophy of the program. And based on past research that I've done on the effects of welfare on families, I would expect that we would begin to see actual, you know, positive changes.
And looking at the numbers as you have, what do you think now that the country is looking at tweaking the program, of updating it, what changes would you suggest might improve those numbers further?
To tell you the truth, I think the program has really worked quite well the way it is. The states are given considerable latitude, and certainly there are differences in attitudes about welfare and the way programs should be administered exactly. There are federal rules that all of the states essentially must follow related to the welfare reform. But the states still have a chance to experiment on their own and try different things. And, you know, thus far it's worked. You know, the major components of welfare reform and why it has really produced a change are that there is now a time limit, and that it's not only simply saying that you have only 5 years on the program, but what that conveys, the meaning of that, is that this is not, this cannot be a lifetime choice for somebody.
June O'Neill is former director of the Congressional Budget Office and co-author of the study Gaining Ground, Measuring the Impact of Welfare Reform on Welfare and Work. Under new changes being pushed now by President Bush, welfare recipients would have to participate in supervised work, training, or drug treatment for 40 hours a week. That's a 10-hour increase over current requirements. Critics say the work requirement forces single mothers to choose between their children and the money they need to survive. But President Bush says that the key to welfare success lies in requiring recipients to work for their aid.
We should not weaken the work requirement in the welfare. We ought to set high standards and aim for those standards. Anything that weakens the work requirement in a welfare reauthorization bill hurts the people we're trying to help.
As Congress debates the next phase of welfare reform, we're asking, is welfare on the right track? Does welfare as we now know it work? Should welfare mothers with children be asked to work full-time like so many middle- and upper-class American women? Or do mothers, poor mothers, and their children have special needs? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Terry O'Neill. She's an attorney and vice president for membership with the National Organization for Women. Good evening and welcome, Terry O'Neill.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Good to have you. Also with us from Washington is Robert Rector. He's a senior research fellow in welfare and family issues at the Heritage Foundation and author of the study Welfare Reform, Requiring Work and Rebuilding Marriage. Good evening and welcome, Robert Rector.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. And from Vermont Public Radio, our own news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Terry O'Neill, jump in here with us. Everything we've heard so far this hour is extremely laudatory of the effects of the welfare reform of 1996. There were people who predicted in 96 that this would create mayhem and drive millions of Americans into a terrible situation. So far, what we're hearing is our numbers that Americans respond very well to, that their welfare rolls are down by half since 96. Is it all sunshine here?
Well, the rolls may be down by half, but let's think back to what is the purpose of welfare. The purpose of welfare is to move families out of poverty and into self-sufficiency. Kicking half the people off welfare doesn't necessarily achieve that purpose. And to say the welfare is working because we've kicked half the people off, well, that's not hard. You know, that doesn't take a lot of effort. And so half the people being kicked off, that doesn't mean that they've been moved out of poverty and into self-sufficiency.
Well, is it specifically kicked off, Terry O'Neill, or perhaps have they left voluntarily to find that job knowing that they won't have welfare forever?
That is a wonderful question, and unfortunately, the way the law is structured, you can't answer it. Why? Because there is no requirement for the states to systematically track welfare leavers so that analysts could go in and actually compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges to figure out where are these people going. What we do know is that soup kitchens, the use of those soup, soup kitchens has exploded in recent years. Some of the private studies, private institutions, went out and tried to study what was going on with welfare leavers, and they found that a very large percentage, up to a third in some cases, of families that left welfare, the kids went hungry on a regular basis. The children went without health care because they lost their health insurance on a regular basis. The families lost their housing on a regular basis. I don't call that success. Now, there are some people who do call it success, but we don't.
But what about the notion, Terry O'Neill, that even if it's hard at first, that this is the time-honored American tradition of struggling on to the ladder of work and struggling up the ladder of work? If you never work, you don't get on the ladder. If you're on, even if things are hard, you're on the ladder.
Well, let's look at what it really takes to achieve that. It's really pretty simple. You need three things. You need education, you need work supports, and you need the kinds of work supports that will help you achieve the job. You need education to qualify for the job. You need fair opportunities to get those jobs, and then you need the work supports to be able to stay on the job. So what would a real welfare system that was aimed at moving people into self-sufficiency and into work, what would it look like? First of all, get the people an education. The current welfare system deprives poor people of an education.
How so?
How so? Yeah. Well, what was it that Wade Horn said just a few months ago? He said he didn't want the welfare system to be used by poor people for an education. Why, that would make welfare into a college scholarship program for poor people, as if that's a bad thing. Okay, that's Wade Horn's attitude. Now, you need the education, and they're not getting it in the welfare system. Secondly, you need the fair opportunities. Most of the people on welfare are women, and women have systematically been excluded from the really good jobs with the fair opportunities for advancement, the union jobs, the jobs in technology, the jobs like carpentry and plumbing and so forth. You need to open those up for women so they can get into the good jobs and support their families. And then you need the work support. You need child care, you need health insurance, you need housing subsidies, and you need transportation subsidies. You can't get to your job, you can't keep the job. It's not complicated, and frankly, it's not that expensive.
Robert Rector, Terry O'Neill says behind the numbers of the drop in welfare recipients, it's not such a pretty picture. What's your view?
Well, it's a very ugly picture that she presents. Unfortunately, everything that she says is completely inaccurate. Let's just concentrate on a few things. Her organization, the National Organization of Women, when this act was passed, predicted it would throw millions of additional children into poverty. Let's just look what happened. What happened was that for a quarter of a century before welfare reform, for example, the black child poverty in the United States, the poverty rate remained absolutely constant. It did not go down at all. Then the reform came along, and the poverty rate of black children fell by a third, an absolutely unprecedented drop, and is now at the lowest point in U.S. history. The same thing happened to the poverty rate of single mothers. After remaining flat or growing for a quarter of a century, it drops by a full third and is now at the lowest point in U.S. history. This is an unprecedented social science success, and it clearly is related to welfare reform. Nothing like this ever happened in any previous economic boom. By requiring single mothers to enter the labor force and to engage in work, what we have seen is an unprecedented growth in employment, particularly among the most disadvantaged single mothers. Their employment rates have gone up 50 to 100%. And as their employment rates have gone up, poverty has gone down for the first time in three decades. The people that did not like this reform in 96 said it was going to be a failure. The track record is exactly the opposite, but they still don't like this reform. They're still going to try to undermine it.
Robert Rector, hang on for a moment. Jack Beatty, there's a lot to dig into here, but first thoughts before we go to a break.
Well, it's interesting. The National Public Radio and the Kaiser Family Foundation did a study of public attitudes toward welfare, and they found the public they liked this welfare reform law, but they agreed with Ms. O'Neill that they wanted more for the poor. Large majorities wanted additional government aid, and 94% wanted job training programs, 94% wanted improved public schools, 85% wanted increased subsidies for daycare and subsidized housing, on and on. So the public seems to be willing to be a lot more generous than the politicians.
But right now, it's headed the other way. Congress is looking at asking for more of welfare recipients. What do you think? Is it the right thing? Are we headed in the right direction here? Should welfare recipients work 40 hours a week just like you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about welfare as we know it now, not as we knew it 10 years ago or even 6.5 years ago, but welfare as we know it now. Our guests tonight are Terry O'Neill with the National Organization for Women and Robert Rector with the Heritage Foundation. You can join us as well. What do you think? Should poor Americans work full time for welfare or be given more time for training? Which do we hold higher in this country, the work ethic or family values? Who's to care for the kids while mom flips burgers? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Rector, the move now is to require more hours from people on welfare to work or to get training. Do you think that's the right direction to be going in? President Bush, we heard him say earlier in the program, says don't cut back on hours. But in fact, that's not what's on the table. It's more hours.
Well, what the overall work requirement or activity requirement under the new law will go up from about 30 hours to 40 hours, mm-hmm. but it's not 40 hours of work. It's about 24 hours of work and can be combined with education and training for the remaining hours. Mm-hmm. Why is this important? For the simple reason that it's the lack of hours of work which is the principal remaining cause of child poverty in the United States today.
You mean people aren't working enough to bring home the right size
right.
paycheck?
When you look at poor families with children, the median family works about between 800 and 1,000 hours a year. No matter what the wage rate is, that's about half time during the course of the whole year. That family is going to remain poor unless we can get the number of hours of work up dramatically. There are a number of things we need to do in that regard, but one of them is to insist that when you're on welfare, you need to develop the habits of much greater hourly participation or weekly participation in the labor force. Basically, we were told 5 years ago, you can't do that, it won't work, and we're getting the same rhetoric again. Mm-hmm. But what mm-hmm. we're going to see is that the single mothers are going to respond to these new, somewhat stronger work requirements in the same positive way they responded in the last 5 years. And if we can go forward to this next step, we're going to see continuing dramatic declines in child poverty.
And Robert Rector, what about the issue of child care? Middle and upper class families, mothers seem to have a hard enough time figuring it out. How does it work for a poor woman who doesn't have much money, but she has to go off to work? What happens to the kids?
Well, she should be getting child care subsidies. The law says she can't be required to do anything if she really can't obtain child care. But child care has essentially been self-funding under the reform. As the caseloads go down, we're paying far fewer, less money out in terms of actual cash welfare checks. All of the savings, as we spend less on conventional welfare, are being reallocated and spent in daycare. So every time a family goes off of conventional welfare, it's freeing up about $5,000 under the system, all of which can be used to pay for daycare for that family or for that family and several other families as well. It's been quite effective in working and providing daycare assistance over the last 5 years.
Terry O'Neill, it sounds like we're hearing from two different planets here. In Robert Rector's view, things are going very well. Well, I mean, the numbers that are laid out there sound in many ways encouraging. Poverty levels down to historic lows, that must be a big deal.
Well, if the poverty levels are down to historic lows, why is it that 48.7% of households recently leaving welfare for full-time work report worrying about having enough food, and 27% actually skipped meals? And as to the child care, let me just tell you what Wade Horn said recently. He said that he thought that the government's child care subsidy programs were, quote-unquote, quite generous. This is what he considers generous. The program is funded at 12% of need. The program is funded at 12% of need, and Wade Horn says that that's generous. Yeah, it is true. And Wade Horn says that that's generous, and that's the problem here.
But are you suggesting then that 88% of people who need child care subsidies can't get them, Terry O'Neill? Is that what that suggests?
Who are eligible for the child care and early childhood development block grant program. 88% of eligible families
Secretary,
are not getting
Secretary
it.
Secretary Thompson testified about that figure specifically before the Ways and Means Committee and completely demolished it. If you use numbers like that, of course you can make the most amazing success look terrible. But let's just take the basic numbers from the Census Bureau. The Census Bureau tells us that from the mid-1990s to the present, the black child poverty rate fell from around 44% of black children to around 33% of black children, and that had never happened before in U.S. history. Now, if this is such a disaster, why is the Census Bureau telling us that black child poverty and poverty of single mothers has declined in an unprecedented and dramatic fashion?
What about it, Terry O'Neill? Are you saying you don't buy the numbers? You think the Census Bureau got it wrong, or that the poverty level is defined incorrectly? It doesn't really capture poverty?
I find it astonishing that anyone would say, let's create a program and create eligibility for child care funding and then not fully fund it. You know, I mean, the point is, let's have a commitment right now and right here tonight. If Mr. Rector would say, yes, I would support a full commitment for full funding of the child care needs of the folks who are eligible for that program. If I heard someone saying, whatever the number is, we're gonna fully fund it. Head Start, one of the most successful programs for poor families, is currently funded at just 2/3 of need.
Robert Rector, how about the child care figure here? Are you ready to see a government commitment to funding it fully as women go off to work?
Let's just look at the question she evaded. Her organization 5 years ago predicted that there were going to be dramatic increases in child poverty. The Census Bureau tells us that there's been an unprecedented drop in child poverty.
We've got that point, and you've made it, and we see it.
Okay.
But what about the further question?
Okay, the point is that the act as it's currently constituted essentially says that no mother on TANF can be required to undertake any activity if she cannot obtain child care for her children.
This is the new temporary assistance for needy families.
That's a wonderful provision, and I support it completely. Okay, if it's necessary, and if we can demonstrate that it's necessary to put some more money into daycare in order to facilitate greater employment, that is something that I think we can do as well. But we don't need alarming statistics about how some 80% of people can't get daycare subsidies and so forth. The fact of the matter is that there's been a huge surge in employment among single mothers. Unprecedented in the history of our country in the last 5 years, and there's been a great increase in daycare use and daycare expenditures. The bulk of TANF money is now spent for daycare. It's not spent for cash aid, because the number of people that are sitting at home and drawing welfare checks is down so far. What are we spending that money on? We're spending all the money that used to be paid for welfare checks mainly for daycare. And under the system, we're going to see more of that. Less reward for people sitting at home, and more subsidies for daycare and for training and employment and for work services in order to help these mothers get into the labor force. I think it's worked very well for 5 years, and what we need to do is go on and continue and intensify it.
Jack Beatty, jump in here with us. What do you make of this sharply split-screen view of the world, of the success of welfare reform or failures, as Terry O'Neill would have it?
Well, I don't know. I don't have any command of these statistics. I do see here a statistic in front of me that the United Nations Children's Fund says that the United States ranks second only to Mexico in the rate of child poverty among the 29 members of the Organization of Economic Development.
Well, now, well,
of course,
Robert Rector, just a moment. Jack, I want to come in just for a moment. Robert Rector, why is that funny?
Well, yeah, why was that
funny? Absolutely preposterous. I mean,
Are you saying that this study is wrong?
I'll tell you what it is. I'll tell you why it's wrong.
Yeah.
Basically, you have different poverty levels in the different countries, and what they're measuring is a standard that's very different in Mexico and relative to the United States.
But the OECD is full of wealthy countries.
Well, it's the same thing. It's still a floating standard, and when you use a more uniform standard, you do not get a result like that. In fact, what you find is that that poor Americans do reasonably well in terms of food intake, their living space, and things like that. But if you use
a standard depending on the country's affluence, granted, but still, it is striking. Jack, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just was curious about that.
Well, I was also going to point out that other studies have to be, beyond the question of daycare, have pointed to what happens when these people go to work. And according to a study from the Economic Policy Institute, which, of course, tracks with intuition, nearly half of those who do move from welfare to work are still unable to afford the bare essentials, food, housing, medical care. And another study by the Manpower Research Development Corporation suggests that that teenagers perform worse at school when their mothers go to work. So it seems to me that beneath the statistics I'm just saying, beneath the statistics of people going to work, we have to ask, what is that work? And is that work enough to sustain a life? Recently, Barbara Ehrenreich won a National Book Award for a book in which she, a PhD in chemistry, worked for 6 months in low-wage work. And she could not both work full-time and find a place to live in several locales around the country, in Florida, and then again in Minnesota. She simply could not earn enough working full-time to pay for her car, to pay for her rent, and to eat. And she did nothing else on the side. And it was kind of like an exercise in, all right, well, let's see. Mm-hmm. The welfare program says go to work. Well, let's see what work is like in low-wage America. And that was what it was like. And among other things, she discovered that people at Walmart, where she was working, where they earned $7 an hour, many of them were also getting food stamps.
Listeners, we're hearing two very different views of what welfare reform has meant. The numbers of Americans on welfare are way down, and the country all surveys show applauds this. But what's behind the numbers? What does it mean? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
I think, you know, politicians for the most part, you know, it's a lot of rhetoric. I'm a man who grew up in the welfare system as a young child.
Okay.
Went through the Head Start program, and I've seen repeatedly my mother was penalized for trying to lift us out of poverty, even with the new President Clinton's welfare reform.
How was she penalized, John?
Well, she would try to go to school. You know, she started at the community college, you know, had a great propensity and earned, you know, almost mm-hmm. straight A's. Mm-hmm. But yet she found that she had to drop out and get another part-time job because they cut back the food stamps or they cut back the housing subsidy. So I think that as long as politicians, for the most part, when they haven't grown up in the system, they have no idea what it's like for a child to go hungry, you know, or a child to see his mother struggling. And it's heartbreaking for me, you know, and because I grew up in it. So it's, you know,
But John, you sound old enough that you must have grown up in the pre-reform welfare system.
Yeah, I grew up. I put myself through college and had to, even while I'm working, you know, full-time, putting myself through college, you know, sending money mm-hmm. home to help out my brothers and sisters and my mom at home. You know, and it's just a terrible thing, you know, and I haven't seen any politician that take the necessary steps to address it and not penalize the mothers that are trying to, you know, do better.
Mm. John, thank you for your call. Terry O'Neill, where is the right balance here so that we don't create a kind of dependency that traps people in dependence on the government? Yet, we don't cut people off of the knees when they want to go out and work.
Well, the old system was deeply, deeply flawed and now repeatedly called for reform of the old system. We think that the reform that we got was wrongheaded and did do a lot of harm and is continuing to do harm. We think that the way this ought to work is that we need to structure a system that will effectively move people out of poverty and into self-sufficiency. One of the problems, perhaps, is with the federal poverty standard, which I believe for a family of four is set at something like $14,000 per year income.
I think it's $17,400,
right. Listen to these numbers. A self-sufficiency wage for a family of, let's see, a single parent with two children, the self-sufficiency wage, if she lives in Monmouth, New Jersey, is $40,000 a year. But by contrast, if that parent with those two kids lives in Springfield, Illinois, the self-sufficiency wage would be $24,000 per year. Two points here. Number one, the federal poverty standard standard is a problem because it doesn't take the same amount of money in all parts of the country to keep body and soul together and to raise your children and keep a roof over the head and so forth. Number two, it's very, very rare anywhere in this country that you can, for $14,000, keep your family together. So the poverty, the so-called poverty standard is artificially low.
Robert Rector, if I may.
It needs to be more nuanced across the country.
Let me put that to you, Robert Rector. Both Jack Beattie and Terry have raised this issue of people going to work, getting off welfare, and then finding themselves in fairly difficult, if not impossible, circumstances. What's your philosophical view of that kind of borderland where you're working, but life is darn tough and maybe not quite possible to hold together?
We ought to ask the question, who has improved the economic well-being of these families? The poverty measure that I'm citing, which is the one that's normally used, which was invented in the 1960s under the Lyndon Johnson administration until like the last month or so, was really the main measure. It's put out every year by the Census Bureau. All the opponents, all the liberal groups in the United States that opposed welfare reform predicted without any equivocation, including now, that this reform was going to raise poverty by that standard. It's also important to remember that for 25 years, from 1970 to 1995, there had been no decline in child poverty using that standard. Along comes this horrible reform, which was condemned, and all of a sudden, the single poverty rate of single mothers, of black children, all these things drop in an unprecedented way. Huge, huge drops.
We take
and
your
so
point, and it's a fair
now?
One, but
we're going to change the standard and say, well, let's not measure welfare reform against the standard which we used for the last three decades, where the previous.
Does that mean you're not willing to address that question, Robert Rector?
I'm willing to address the question that you need to look, for example, at child hunger. What we see, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, is that in the last 5 years, child hunger has been cut in half. Is there still some child hunger left in the United States? Yes, there is. Do we need to bring it down more? Yes, there is. Is there still child poverty left in the United States? Yes, there is. But what we have seen is dramatic progress against child poverty based on this reform. That's an indication to me that you don't want to go back and reverse the fundamental principles of reform, or that you don't want to suddenly in midstream invent a new standard by which all policies would completely fail, because you don't want to acknowledge that you were wrong and that this policy has produced dramatic economic uplift as much as we would like? No. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a very, very long time to bring all families up to the living standard that we would like. But in order to do that, we must have a system that requires and promotes work. We also need to have a system that encourages marriage rather than penalizes it.
We'll talk about that. I want to ask you, Jack Beattie, what do you think? Are liberal advocates of the poor moving the goalposts here now after welfare reform has worked?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have myself had trouble with that poverty line, since it was based upon a market basket of food products you could purchase in 1962 or three. And of course, food has remained the price of food has actually gone down dramatically since then, whereas housing, which wasn't included in that original measure, has gone way up in some localities. So there's an argument that all along this has been a flawed measure.
We're talking about welfare as we know it now this hour, 6 years after the huge welfare reform. The roles have been cut in half. Are we on the right track? Has America learned something about poverty? Has America licked welfare dependency? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about welfare as we know it now. Should poor Americans work full-time for welfare or be given more time for training? Which do we hold higher in this country, the work ethic or family values? Who's to care for the kids while mom flips burgers? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Join us. We're joined by Terry O'Neill with the National Organization for Women and Robert Rector from the Heritage Foundation, and now by Gabriel. Welcome, Gabriel. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make the point that to understand the true agenda behind welfare reform, you have to look beyond these neo-Victorian cliches about the dignity of work and such, and understand who stands to gain and who stands to win. I think that welfare functions basically as a price support on labor, much like price supports on dairy products or lumber or steel. Now, the farms and the steel makers and the lumber industry all have their price support still in place, but the ordinary working people with this welfare reform have had a price support cut out from under them. The more people you send to work, the lower the wages go down. It's an iron law of supply and demand, and there's no way around it.
But, Gabriel, do you think that that might not still be better than sitting at home, you know, doing nothing on welfare?
Well, that depends. I mean, if you're holding a $10 an hour job and someone else is sitting at home doing nothing, but you get to keep your job at $10 an hour, you'd say it's a good system. When the person on the couch has to get up and come to work and now you're both getting paid $8 an hour because more of you are competing for the same amount of money and wages and jobs, that's bad.
Mm. Gabriel, we got your point. So, Jack Beattie, is it a zero-sum system here, do you think, around labor?
I'm still trying to take in that sort of breathtaking economic analysis, and I see his point. It is so hard for poor people today, and clearly any incentives that can get them to work, that can get them, and I don't think it's just a neo-Victorian cliche. I mean, work is important. It's one of the ways we get pride in ourselves, and I think everybody mm-hmm. wants people to work. But, you know, this law has anomalies in it that need to be corrected. The New York Times front page today points to a crucial one. All agree that lack of marriage is one of the causes of poverty. Two people can do it better than one. They can pay more for one. And yet strict welfare rules, work rules, apparently are discouraging marriage formation in a very counterproductive way.
Yeah, very interesting.
Which is to say, yeah, now that strikes me as something that could undermine any benefit you could get from a woman working. Because if she's working full-time at such a low-wage job, as our caller pointed out, she can earn enough to get by.
Dina's on the line. Welcome, Dina. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. Thanks to the screener who kindly accepted my call. I have two quick comments. One is, I've heard statistics that most single mothers on welfare are white, and I'm hearing a lot of talk about black children. And my second comment is, I've been a daycare teacher for about 15 years, mm-hmm. and I'm not hearing the word quality in front of daycare. The most child care available is unfortunately not quality daycare. It's academically based instead of play-based. It's not developmentally appropriate, and it's appalling.
Dina, do you think that lower quality child care would be more likely to be offered to women coming off welfare, or is this across the board?
I think across the board, even middle America, people with, you know, upper middle incomes, there's just not a lot of quality child care out there.
Mm. Dina, thanks for your call. Terry O'Neill, what about this? This is an interesting spot where family values and child rearing and child care issues intersect both for people in or near poverty and for people who are middle class. It's tough for everybody, isn't it?
Well, it absolutely is. I mean, every parent is a working person, I guess you might say. And the caller is absolutely right. There is not nearly enough quality child care in this country. We need to have it across the board. And in fact, now has called for recognition of the right of every child in this country to be well cared for from the moment of birth on up. We have a public school system in this country which has been attacked by right-wing extremists, but is nonetheless a basically good public school system, needs a lot of improvement. We need to have the same attitude about early childhood development in this country. Every child deserves it, no matter what socioeconomic stratum that the child is born into.
Gordon's on the line. Welcome, Gordon. You're on
yes,
the air.
Yes, welcome. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Jack, I often think of your article in the Atlantic Monthly a few years ago, the worst thing that Clinton did, and that was to sign in the reform program. I'm basically I work at a community center, and I basically see what's happening day to day, particularly the increase in terms of people coming to us for food. Today alone, five families came to us for shelter who were out. I think the issue of in the so-called thrifty program, where someone pushed a market basket through the shopping center and said, well, this is what is going to happen. One-third will be for food. The reality in Worcester, for example, one-bedroom apartment, $600 average, two-bedroom, $800, and three-bedroom, which is what we need, $1,000.
So you don't think welfare reform's working, Gordon?
No, not at all. I mean, the reason why many of the people have been off, and I've spoken to many, many people who have gone off the rolls, is due to sanctions or just, you know, in some cases, the meanness that happens. The issue for me, though, is that I think it's almost worth having a summit and scrapping the whole system as it is now. I can see flaws in this and the old system, obviously, and particularly in the direction that it's going.
So you'd like to see it all turned over. Gordon, thanks for your call. Our time is running down. Robert Rector, this is always tough. These are people who don't have a lot, and people are going to be concerned however you push them. It's a tough picture, even when they get to work.
Absolutely. It's a very difficult row to hoe if you are a very low-educated single mom who's had a child out of wedlock. This is a tough situation. However, the fact is that the fate, the economic conditions of that group as a whole have improved dramatically, no matter what standard. You can use the old standard or you can invent a new one. The bottom line would be that single-parent families have improved an awful lot, no matter what standard you would like, as long as you're honest and using real data from the government over the last 5 years.
And Terry O'Neill, I'm sorry, Robert Rector, but our time is almost out. Terry O'Neill, final thought. Americans seem very supportive of these welfare reforms.
Well, I think what we need is education to get the job, a fair job opportunity, and critical work supports. What does Bush give us? George W. Bush gives us work longer hours and get yourself married. That is not a prescription for moving families out of poverty and into self-sufficiency. You need the education, the fair job opportunities, and the work supports, none of which is included in Bush's proposal. And we hope that that people will urge their senators to reject this punitive measure and adopt measures that will, in fact, move people out of poverty.
The debate goes on. Terry O'Neill, thank you for joining us. Terry O'Neill is with the National Organization for Women. And Robert Rector, thank you. Robert Rector is Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Jack Beatty, hang on. We're going to listen to something here. You can continue this conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, novelist Alice McDermott seeks salvation for the Catholic Church. This is On Point. Novelist and National Book Award winner Alice McDermott gave this year's commencement address at Regis College, a Catholic women's college in Massachusetts. Her speech tracked a year that witnessed the Catholic Church at its finest and, perhaps, at its worst. But McDermott points out that though the unfolding scandal has revealed a tragic flaw in the Church, it's a flaw that can be resolved by Catholic women. Here now are excerpts from her speech.
Signs and symbols. The events of September 11th offer many. Those of us accustomed to seeking them out make note, for instance, that the first death certificate written on that terrible day was for Father Judge, the fire department chaplain, a Catholic priest killed while ministering to his people. In my own parish, and inside the Beltway parish filled with busy professionals, a hastily scheduled Mass at 9:30 on the evening of September 11th filled the church to capacity, and the eloquent sermon by our young priest made tangible, in a way many of us had never experienced before, our great need for all the church provides, a place to grieve, to join hands, to be renewed. We read on to find the church that served us so well in September, that served so many of the dead, firefighters, police officers, Irish, Italian, Hispanic, New Yorkers, in spring is diminished, publicly humiliated by its own foolishness. The beautiful language of our liturgy, the comforting eloquence of our priests that was so essential to us in September is tainted by doublespeak, evasion, or an awkward silence. In his first public statement about the scandal, Pope John Paul called it evidence of the evil at work in the world. Those of us accustomed to looking for metaphors and portents and grand themes, who recognize in literature at least the workings of good and evil, heard the resonance in the pontiff's choice of the word. Evil has infiltrated our church and laid it low just at the moment its strength is most needed. Such evil does not enter the human drama arbitrarily. Reading the tragedy of this scandal, I look for character motivation and begin to understand how the leaders of our church might have been moved to retain and to protect the worst of its priest in order to preserve the public image of a rapidly shrinking priesthood. Irony enters the story. We are a church of seven sacraments, except that, as even my 13-year-old daughter has noticed, for half our population, there are only six. At the center of our liturgy, there is the Eucharist, our comfort and our strength, the body and blood of our Lord, offered for the salvation of us all. But our leaders prefer that the consecrated host be held aloft by a criminal rather than a woman. But for the sake of custom, or complacency, or convenience, or a lingering cultural misogyny, we have developed the habit, the tragic flaw, of dismissing truth with a wink and a nod. The tragic flaw that has led to a desperate shortage of priests, which has led to a desperate attempt to preserve the priesthood at any cost, which has led to the infiltration of evil and the humiliation of the leaders of our church, just as all the signs and symbols indicate that our church is most needed. This is the unfolding story of our time, and its resolution, its redemption, the good that will triumph over this evil, is all in the future, and you are the future.
Novelist Alice McDermott at Regis College's commencement. Jack Beattie, McDermott says, such evil does not enter the human drama arbitrarily. There are reasons, she's suggesting.
Yes, and she unfolds them in a very surprising and provocative way. She says there are seven sacraments, but only six of them apply to women. The one that doesn't is the sacrament of holy orders, the sacrament of ordination that allows people to become priests. And she very plausibly and logically lays out how that exclusion has helped to create this current scandal, that all along it was sustained by a kind of, as she puts it, wink and a nod, you know, well, we don't need women, mm-hmm. and that not allowing married clergy and not allowing women to be priests means there are fewer priests. Fewer priests mean that the bishops have to be lenient to the offenders, and therefore we have more offenders.
And it's a speech to young Catholic women she's calling to the ramparts.
Yes, and she's saying that it's up to them to renew the church.
Well, everyone's talking about renewal. There's a call in another quarter. Jack Beattie, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
On Point is produced. Senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.